and sportsmanship to truly test his horse. The charge cut deep. The issue came to a head that September. Seabiscuit had been entered in both the Hawthorne Gold Cup in Chicago and the Narragansett Special in Rhode Island. The races were both scheduled for September 11th. Narragansett assigned Seabiscuit a leaden 132 pounds, while Hawthorne gave him 128. Howard agonized over the decision. He didn't want to burden Seabiscuit with 132 pounds, but he knew that going the way of the lighter weight would draw criticism. Howard opted to break his 130 maximum rule and promised that Seabiscuit would run at Narragansett under 132 pounds. On the race's eve, a downpour rendered the track at Narragansett a quagmire. Seabiscuit had a reputation for being a terrible mudder. The charge was an exaggeration, but his performances were compromised by a wet surface. According to Pollard, Seabiscuit ran with a nervous, quick, belly-down stride that made mud running difficult. "You know how Jack Dempsey used to punch short, snappy jolts?" Pollard asked. "This is exactly how the Biscuit runs. On a muddy track, Biscuit can't use those short steps. In mud, a horse has to leap, and that's not the Biscuit style. It would get him utterly untracked and he could do nothing." Pollard, in his odd way, urged others to forgive the horse this one flaw. "We have to give him a break," he said to journalist David Alexander, his close friend. "There's more than one thing I can't do, and there are a lot more things than that that you can't do or you wouldn't be in the newspaper business. You'd be a jockey and a scholar and a connoisseur of femininity, like I am." Psychological reasons also played a role. Seabiscuit hated to be pelted in the face with mud thrown up by other horses. "He just made up his mind that he didn't like it," Smith explained. "And he's got a pretty definite mind. Alone, he could work well on the worst kind of a track, but when it splattered in his face, and particularly in his ears, he wanted no part of it. Well, he'd go on, try. He wouldn't have quit in a Wyoming hailstorm where they'd come down as big as golf balls, but he couldn't, somehow, give his best. And why punish him unnecessarily?" Smith was also concerned about soundness. At Santa Anita, the horse had slipped and kicked himself during a mud workout. Knowing that his colt had had some leg trouble in the past, Smith wanted to avoid mud whenever possible. But Howard had made a promise to run at Narragansett, and had he scratched the horse so late, it would have looked as if he had never intended to run. He was again forced to choose between his image and his trainer's wishes, and Howard was a man who had great difficulty compromising his image. So, swimming in fetlock deep slop and conceding as many as 24 pounds to his adversaries, Seabiscuit finished third, snapping his historic win streak. Howard couldn't win. "The consensus was that Seabiscuit should not have been started in the mud," wrote Oscar Otis, echoing the words of many columnists. "Why he was started anyway is not known, but it seems a shame that his unbeaten record for the Eastern Invasion was not kept unsullied." Gradually the sniping died off, but they hadn't seen the last of muddy tracks or hard choices. On October 12, 1937, after a month's rest, Seabiscuit resumed his winning ways in smashing style, bounding home first under 130 pounds in the rich Continental Handicap at New York's Jamaica Racetrack. The victory bumped him up to the top spot in the 1937 earnings race. With $152,780, he was now some $8,000 ahead of War Admiral. As he streaked under the wire, the fans began chanting, "Bring on your War Admiral!" Smith and the Howards knew that War Admiral was not going to come to them. They shipped down to Maryland, where War Admiral was completing his training for his return to racing, and prepared to meet him there. There were three possibilities for a meeting: Laurel Racecourse's Washington Handicap on October 30th, Pimlico Racecourse's Pimlico Special on November 3rd, and Pimlico's Riggs Handicap on November 5th. Both horses were entered in all three. A meeting now seemed certain. For Smith, the trip to Maryland was gratifying. His accomplishments with Seabiscuit were the wonder of the racing world, and the man who had been considered an obscure oddball a year before now enjoyed cult status among his peers. Across the backstretch, other trainers began to mix up homemade liniments, trying to brew what they called Smith's magic salves. Everyone wanted to know what sort of shoes he was putting on his horses. They began to watch everything he did and query him about his training practices, from feed to workouts. One enterprising promoter even offered to pay Smith to hold training tutorials. Smith was incredulous. He insisted that the training community was missing the point. It wasn't the shoes or the liniments. "We have a great horse," he said. "That's all there is to it. And we tried to use common sense in training him and in racing him." There was one admirer whom Smith didn't brush off. On October 16th, he led a blanketed Seabiscuit into the paddock for the Laurel Handicap. 20,000 people crammed into the track to see him. As Smith walked Seabiscuit into the paddock stall, a stooped man emerged from the crowd and approached him. "I'm Fitzsimmons," he said, as if Smith didn't know. "I want to ask you a favor." Smith, a little starstruck, listened. "Mr. Smith, I'm very fond of Seabiscuit, and I would consider it an honor if you would permit me to hold him while he is being saddled." Smith's eyes shone as he handed Fitzsimmons the reins. He quietly saddled Seabiscuit while Fitzsimmons stood at the head of the horse he had lost. In a few moments, the horse was ready, and Fitzsimmons passed the reins back and stepped away. Smith turned back to his horse and collected himself. It was, he would say later, the greatest moment of his life. 10 minutes later, Seabiscuit finished in a dead heat for first with a horse named Heelfly, who carried 15 fewer pounds. In the jockey's room, Pollard surely never heard the end of it. George Wolfe had ridden Heelfly. The meeting with War Admiral, slated for the Washington Handicap, was just 2 weeks away. A storm front rolled in and stalled over Maryland, drenching the track day after day. Smith urged Howard to pass on the entry in the Washington Handicap. Howard, ever the optimist, insisted that the track would be dry and entered the horse. He was wrong. The morning of the race, an inspection of the track revealed a boggy surface, especially along the rail where Seabiscuit preferred to run. This time they would not be pressured into starting. Seabiscuit was scratched. With Smith watching from the track apron, War Admiral led from wire to wire, winning easily. After the race, Howard learned that members of the Riddle Barn were publicly mocking him for being afraid of War Admiral. He was furious. Though both horses were still entered in the Pimlico Special and Riggs Handicaps, each race would feature a full field. Howard and Smith much preferred that the horses meet in a definitive one-on-one match, in which no other horses could cause interference or otherwise affect the outcome. Howard again tried to arrange a match race. The man he approached was Alfred Gwynn Vanderbilt, Jr., a dead ringer for actor Jimmy Stewart. Vanderbilt was a gangly 25-year-old whose gentle, self-effacing manner belied his fabulous wealth. His father was heir to the Vanderbilt Railroad and Oceanic shipping fortune. His mother's father had invented the fantastically lucrative Bromo Seltzer. In May 1915, when a German submarine torpedoed the Lusitania and sent the liner and Alfred's father to the bottom of the Atlantic, 2-year-old Alfred had inherited $5.8 million in government bonds, a fortune augmented by $2 million more, and a sprawling Maryland property when he turned 21 in 1933. Dubbed the nation's most eligible bachelor, Vanderbilt eschewed the debauchery that would have tempted other men fresh out of their teens and into a bottomless bank account. He had fallen madly and intractably in love with horse racing from the moment he saw his first race as a child and knew where he wanted his money to go. He bought controlling interest in Baltimore's legendary but struggling Pimlico racecourse and set out to restore its glory. In spite of his youth, he proved to be an imaginative and effective businessman. He revolutionized Pimlico, installing a public address system and a modern starting gate and leveling out the large hill in the infield that had given the track its nickname, Old Hilltop, but obstructed the view of the races. By the fall of 1937, Pimlico was beginning to make a comeback, but progress was slow. Vanderbilt wanted a headliner. Howard recognized Vanderbilt's tremendous influence and powers of persuasion and knew that Pimlico needed his horse. He proposed that Vanderbilt try to host a meeting between Seabiscuit and War Admiral. He told him that he'd take a match at any distance from a mile to a mile and a quarter, any time the track was fast. He offered to run against the colt for a small purse or simply for a winner's cup. "I believe Seabiscuit can beat War Admiral," he said. "Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm willing to run against him to test the theory. It is all up to Mr. Riddle." Vanderbilt approached the elder horseman with an offer for a match race for $50,000. Riddle declined. Howard was left with either the Pimlico Special or the Riggs. At first, it appeared that both horses would run in the former, and Maryland geared up for the meeting of the two titans. Again, the weather intervened. 10 straight days of downpour kept Seabiscuit in the barn, taking the edge off of his form. Smith again scratched him. On race day, Smith walked out to the track to see War Admiral run. The Triple Crown winner was a hellion, repeatedly barging through the gate and dragging the assistant starter with him. War Admiral was growing so violent that he was endangering himself and everyone nearby. Head starter Jim Milton tried a new tack. He brought the colt around to the front of the gate, had the assistant place a pair of tongs on the horse's lips to distract him, then had him backed into the stall. It worked. War Admiral quieted down, and Milton was finally able to break the field in good order. Across the track, Smith lifted his binoculars and watched as War Admiral pulled around the far turn, meeting with unexpected pressure from Masked General, who carried 28 fewer pounds. Smith saw Masked General level his eye right at War Admiral. It lasted only a moment, but that was all Smith needed to notice something unusual. For the first time in his career, War Admiral hesitated. Smith thought, "He is befuddled." War Admiral's jockey, Charlie Kurtzinger, also seemed confused. An instant later, War Admiral pulled himself together and won, regaining the lead in the money-winning race. But Smith took note. He believed he had found a way to beat War Admiral. After the race, he was smiling. "Seabiscuit," someone heard him saying, "we'll lick him sure." Riddle was furious with Milton for using the tongs on War Admiral, despite the fact that one of his own employees had reportedly given them to Milton to be used on the colt if he acted up. Riddle had been harboring a grudge against Pimlico since 1926, when the track's racing secretary had assigned his colt Crusader 126 pounds in a major race. Crusader lost to a horse carrying 93 pounds. The tongs incident was the last straw. Riddle didn't want Milton going anywhere near his horse again, and vowed never to run another horse at Pimlico. He had Conway shelve War Admiral for the season. 2 days later, Seabiscuit ran in the Riggs handicap, over the same distance as a Pimlico Special. Members of the Riddle barn came out to the track to watch him. They were treated to quite a spectacle. Seabiscuit annihilated the field, breaking the track record while carrying 130 pounds, two more than War Admiral had lugged in the Pimlico Special. With the victory, Seabiscuit took back the lead in the earnings race, amassing about $9,000 more than War Admiral. Vanderbilt worked on Riddle for a few days to get the owner to rescind his boycott of Pimlico and bring his colt back to meet Seabiscuit. Howard kept his horses in town in case something came of it. For a few days, Vanderbilt thought Riddle would reconsider and run War Admiral in the Bowie handicap. He talked Howard into committing to the race, even though it was at the marathon distance of 1 5/8 miles, farther than Smith wanted to send Seabiscuit. But by race day, it was clear that War Admiral wasn't coming. Trainloads of fans were pouring in for the race, and Howard didn't want to disappoint them, so he agreed to send Seabiscuit out anyway. Carrying 130 pounds, Seabiscuit endured a rough trip and lost by a nose to the brilliant race mare Esposa, who carried 15 fewer pounds and set a track record. With that, the Pimlico season ended. In mid-November, Smith loaded Seabiscuit and the rest of his stable, blanketed in red and white stable colors, into three cars of a train bound for California. The train rolled up the East Coast. It paused at Belmont Park in New York, while Howard completed a transaction. Bing Crosby had long been deeply impressed with Howard's racing success. He once suggested to his wife that they name their son Seabiscuit. But every attempt to emulate his friend ended in spectacular failure. In 1937, Bing joined forces with Howard's polo-playing son, Lynn, to form the Binglin Stock Farm, hoping that Lynn's considerable horsemanship could turn his luck around. That fall, while in Argentina for a polo tournament, Lynn had stumbled upon some promising racehorses. He had purchased several, shipping them by sea to New York. Charles Howard had agreed to pick them up and bring them to California with his own horses. Lynn and Bing told the elder Howard that he could pick out one that he liked and buy him. Howard and Smith came down to the docks to see the horses. Two stood out from the rest. One was Kahak, later renamed Kayak II. Big, black, and gorgeous, he was barely halter-broken and fought every attempt to handle him. The other was a mature horse, Ligurati, Argentina's champion miler. Smith was particularly enamored of Ligurati. Howard liked both horses. He chose to buy Kayak. After tacking on additional rail cars to bear the Binglin horses west, the Seabiscuit train rolled out of the east, across the plains and over the Rockies, desolate and white, and still in their early deep winter. When the train paused at little towns along the route, fans gathered in the cold to peer in the windows and catch a glimpse of Seabiscuit. Ahead, a celebration awaited the travelers. Howard had telephoned Oscar Otis to tell him that Seabiscuit was coming back, and Otis had printed the news. 500 enthusiastic fans were preparing to rise early and come to the track to give the hometown hero a noisy welcome. City and state dignitaries would be there to pair their images with the hottest celebrity in the nation. Even the jaded horsemen would take a respite from their labors to see him, eating their breakfasts outdoors on the benches near the siding. To joyful applause and popping flashbulbs, the horse would draw up in his rail car. He would step from his 3-foot-deep bed of straw, give Smith an affectionate bump with his nose, and leave the train bucking. The men around him would be triumphant and relieved. Even Smith would be in an optimistic, relatively chatty mood, stringing several hundred words together in what the papers would call a great moral victory for the reporters present. But there were long, cold miles to go before they were home. The train rolled through country where the temperature was 14 degrees below zero. Storm after storm buffeted the train and buried the landscape in snow. The going was treacherous and frightening. When the train's water pipes froze, Howard left Marcella in the sleeper car to join Seabiscuit. It was a habit he had learned, looking to the horse to steady himself. He found Seabiscuit warm and drowsy under a double layer of blankets, swaying on his feet as the cars snaked over the mountains. In the icy, rocking train, Howard sat with his horse over the journey home. It was going to be a long, cold winter. Chapter 11. No Pollard, no Seabiscuit. It was December 7, 1937, and Red Pollard was winging around the far turn at Tanforan. He was riding Howard's colt Exhibit, circling the field in a weekday sprint race. He was ticking past horses one by one, watching them waver and fail as his colt powered by. At the juncture between turn and home stretch, he collared the last of the front runners, Halftime, who was laboring along the rail. Ripping down the center of the track, Pollard saw a wide-open lane in front of him. He knew he had more than enough horse under him to last to the wire. Suddenly, Exhibit bolted inward, shying from something to his right. Pollard's weight sank hard into his right stirrup, and he pushed off against it, trying to avoid falling over Exhibit's shoulder and down into the dirt. Exhibit veered toward Halftime. As he careened left, Pollard must have heard the hard, irregular pounding of Halftime's forehooves as his jockey, standing bolt upright in panic, sawed on the reins, trying to back his horse out of the way before Exhibit crashed into him. Halftime's head came up, and he dropped out of the pocket an instant before Exhibit's broad rump bulled into it. Pollard got his weight back under him, straightened the horse's course, and galloped him under the wire first. Halftime's jockey was off his horse and up to the stewards in seconds. Exhibit was promptly disqualified, and the stewards scheduled a meeting to determine if Pollard would have to serve a suspension for the incident. Pollard must have expected to be taken off his weekday mounts for a few days. Though the jockey was probably not at fault for Exhibit's change of course, it was common for stewards to briefly suspend riders caught in his situation to guard against foul play. But no one expected the Tanfren stewards to do what they did. Perhaps they were erring on the side of overpunishment out of concern for the sport's image. Or maybe they wanted to take a strike against Pollard, who delighted in sassing them. He had nicknamed a particularly tyrannical, humorless, and rosy steward Pink Whiskers, a sobriquet that was soon used by all the jockeys. Whatever their motivation, the stewards buried him. Handing out the toughest sentence of the season, they not only suspended Pollard from riding for the rest of the Tanfren meeting, they asked the state racing board, which usually followed their recommendations, to suspend him from riding at any California track for the rest of 1937. Nor was that all. It was customary for stewards to allow suspended jockeys to ride in stakes races except in cases of fraud, of which Pollard was not accused. But the Tanfren stewards scheduled a later meeting to consider taking this privilege away from him as well. The news stunned the Howard barn. Seabiscuit was set to meet War Admiral in the Santa Anita Handicap on March 5th, and his preparations were just getting into high gear. His first prep race was the San Francisco Handicap, to be run on December 15th, during Pollard's suspension. Howard was livid. For the Howards, the jockey had long ago ceased being a mere employee. He was more like a son. For Charles, Pollard may have become a surrogate for little Frankie, the boy he had lost. Both Charles and Marcella fretted like nervous parents over the jockey's welfare. Marcella called the jockey by his childhood name, Johnny. Though Pollard was approaching 30, Charles hadn't been able to break his habit of referring to him as a boy. Any insult to Pollard was received by the Howards as a slight to themselves. Howard's anger over the suspension went beyond loyalty. Riding Seabiscuit was a nuanced task. No other jockey had ever ridden him successfully, and Howard believed no one else could. More important, he knew that Pollard was the jockey best able to protect his horse's idiosyncratic body from injury. "If Pollard rides Seabiscuit," he explained to the press, "I know he will bring the horse back intact, and that is my chief concern." "Nobody," he said, "fits my horse better than that boy." When Pollard returned from his meeting with the stewards that night, there was more bad news. The Turf and Sport Digest sportswriter poll had named War Admiral Horse of the Year, out-balloting Seabiscuit 621-602. Horse and Horseman magazine, which polled horsemen, not sportswriters, had named Seabiscuit Horse of the Year, but the Turf and Sport vote was regarded as the deciding one. There were consolation prizes. Turf and Sport was going to present Seabiscuit with a special plaque commending his performances, and by unanimous vote, they had named him Handicap Champion. But these weren't the honors the Howard barn craved. And Smith had been right about War Admiral. Riddle's camp announced that the horse would not be coming to the Santa Anita Handicap after all. He was off to Florida's Hialeah racetrack, where he was greeted with near hysteria, generating a bigger stir than any Florida visitor save President Roosevelt. Instead of meeting Seabiscuit, War Admiral would face a soft field in Hialeah's Widener Handicap. The next morning, Howard issued his response to Pollard's suspension. "No Pollard, no Seabiscuit." The stewards did not like being threatened. After leaning toward allowing Pollard to ride in his stakes engagements, they changed their minds. He was suspended from all mounts. Howard struck back. As the state racing board prepared to decide whether or not Pollard's suspension would be extended to year's end, Howard scratched Seabiscuit and Fair Nitus from the San Francisco Handicap. Seabiscuit's next scheduled start was in the Christmas Day Handicap, but Howard made it clear that he would pull Seabiscuit from that race and any other if Pollard's suspension were extended. The crisis was escalating rapidly, and Pollard was getting alarmed. He didn't want the horse to miss any races on his account. He approached Howard with a compromise. Get George Wolfe to ride Seabiscuit. Howard wouldn't consider it. He trusted no other rider on his horse. He was going to take the state officials to the mat. On December 22nd, the chairman of the California Horse Racing Commission gathered reporters together and issued the board's decree. Red Pollard was banned from riding all horses, including stakes mounts, until January 1, 1938. 5 minutes later, Charles Howard stormed into the racing secretary's office at Santa Anita and announced that Seabiscuit would not run on Christmas. Seabiscuit idled. He was entered in the New Year's handicap, held on the day Pollard's suspension would end, but that was more than a week away. Smith had to keep him fit through workouts. Every reporter and clocker on the West Coast wanted to sit in on them, and Smith was determined to keep them away. His war with the press resumed. The enemy, Smith discovered, was getting smarter. Knowing that Smith had a history of giving his horse moonlight workouts, the newsman first tried showing up at ungodly hours of the morning. When he led Seabiscuit and Fair Nitus out for what was supposed to be a secret pre-dawn workout veiled in thick fog, Smith discovered a thicket of clockers and reporters waiting for him. Because visibility was so low, they had formed a human chain stretching all the way around the track, each man clocking a portion of Seabiscuit's workout. In spite of the pea soup fog, they caught the biscuit spinning 6 furlongs in 1:14, a solid workout. Smith tried Plan B, working Seabiscuit in the afternoons on Mondays when Santa Anita was closed to racing and the clockers and reporters had gone home. His adversaries guessed his tactic and hung around Santa Anita hour after hour on the following Monday. Seabiscuit didn't show. One by one, the reporters bailed out. As dusk fell, the last one drove away. Seconds later, Smith and Seabiscuit trotted out onto the track. The horse worked in solitude. The next day, the clockers and press got word that they had been duped. The Howards blew time any way they could. They showed up at the barn every morning at 7 sharp, Howard with sugar cubes, Marcella with Wee Biscuit, a toy Scottish terrier given to her during a visit to Bing Crosby's house. The reporters were almost always in tow, and Howard usually created some amusement for them to write up or photograph, including talking Smith into dipping Seabiscuit's hoof in ink and stamping their Christmas cards. In the afternoons, the Howards would walk up to their box for the races. Howard made sport of cornering journalists who had criticized Seabiscuit. Summoning them to the box, he and his whole family would rise together and ask in unison, "Tell us what you have against Seabiscuit." On one of those afternoons, Marcella brought Alfred Vanderbilt up to join them. She introduced him to her cousin, a gorgeous young woman named Manuela Hudson. Vanderbilt was dazzled. A romance began, and Alfred and Manuela were soon engaged. Vanderbilt owed the Howards a favor. Everyone was waiting for the impost announcement for the New Year's handicap. They had reason to worry. Howard's insistence that his horse would not run under more than 130 pounds had put track handicappers in a bind. California racing rules mandated that no horse carry fewer than 100 pounds, and Seabiscuit was clearly more than 30 pounds better than most horses on the West Coast. But Seabiscuit was a fail-safe moneymaker, drawing record crowds and wagering virtually everywhere he showed his face. If tracks wanted the attendance, revenue and exposure that a superstar like Seabiscuit brought, they had to obey Howard's wishes. But if they gave him 130 or fewer pounds, they risked the ire of rival horsemen and the excoriation of journalists. All week before the weights for the New Year's handicap were announced, Howard made warning noises about his 130-pound limit. On the Tuesday before the race, the weights were released. Smith and Howard groaned. Seabiscuit was weighted at 132 pounds. Seabiscuit was getting heavy and stall crazy and desperately needed a race. That night, while playing in his stall, he reared up and smacked his head against the stall door. He came down with a nasty gash 1 millimeter above his right eye. Smith stitched him up, installed a safety door, and damned the racing secretary. Unable to stomach running with 132 pounds, he scratched the horse. Next among race possibilities was a San Pasquale handicap, but again, the secretary assigned him 132 pounds. Howard and Smith again scratched him. Howard started referring to the racing secretary as public enemy number one. Only two races remained on Seabiscuit's schedule before the Santa Anita handicap, the San Carlos on February 19th and the San Antonio on February 26th. Seabiscuit was very, very late in his preparation. A peculiar madness was seizing the press box and clocker stand. There were more than a dozen clockers at the track, yet not one had seen Seabiscuit in a single workout since Santa Anita opened in December. Unable to catch him on their stopwatches, some of them began to circulate old rumors that Seabiscuit was lame. The rumors were quickly picked up by the press, which set out to investigate. While leading Seabiscuit out for walks, Smith stared in amazement as newsmen got down on their hands and knees to see if the horse had a game leg. Howard watched and laughed. Other journalists began seeing ghosts, reporting imaginary sightings of Seabiscuit working late at night. "The mystery of Seabiscuit," wrote David Alexander, "seems to have been bothering a lot of the boys here to the point of a nervous breakdown." January 31st started out as an ordinary Monday for the clockers. They watched the waves of horses coming and going from the track at their usual early morning times. As Santa Anita was closed on Mondays, they would normally have gone home in mid-morning when the workouts were over. But they still hadn't timed a single workout for Seabiscuit since he arrived at Santa Anita a month before. They settled in to wait him out. Gradually, attrition thinned the ranks. By lunchtime, only two hardy clockers remained. A handful of reporters gutted out the wait with them. Their hopes dimmed as they watched a rainstorm approaching. They knew that Seabiscuit didn't work on wet tracks. Shortly after lunch, just before the rains hit, the clockers were startled by an improbable spectacle. Two men and two horses materialized from under the purple storm clouds, walked up the track, and reined up in front of the press box. It was Tom Smith on a broad yellow horse. Alongside him, Red Pollard sat in his customary seat atop the familiar little bay horse. The clockers gaped. Smith was waving at them. They lunged for their stopwatches. Smith, seeing that the track was standing at attention, cantered the horses once around, then pulled up at the finish line while Pollard and his mount peeled off for a workout. With Pollard sitting motionless in the saddle, they reeled off rapid fractions, clipping under the wire after six furlongs. Smith took the horse back to the barn. The reporters bounced along behind, teasing Smith for letting himself get caught. Smith, for some reason not his usual surly self, laughed with them, saying he hadn't been aware that the clockers and reporters were still there. "I figured I'd just steal the march on everybody," he said. "Doggone those clockers. I'll fool them yet." The next morning, the papers were full of the news. But a year of dealing with Tom Smith had gotten to some of the reporters. Paranoia was setting in. Something wasn't right. Wasn't it suspicious that Smith had waved at them? Didn't Seabiscuit seem to be blowing a little too hard after the work? Wasn't it odd that Smith was so amiable about having been caught? Had anyone ever seen him smile before? Could it be that the horse was not Seabiscuit after all? In the press corps, only the Los Angeles Evening Herald's Jack McDonald was willing to speculate publicly, and only in his headline, "Howard Horse Pulled Up Groggy After Fast Work." Back in Barn 38, Smith must have read that headline and smiled. The laughter subsided immediately. A few days after Seabiscuit's six-furlong workout, a tipster contacted the local district attorney's office with a startling claim. On the backstretch at Santa Anita, a man was preparing to harm Seabiscuit. His name was James Manning, and he had infiltrated the barn area with plans to break into Seabiscuit's stall and shove a sponge up his nostril, impeding his breathing. Manning had been sent by a group of men from the East Coast who wanted to ensure that Seabiscuit would lose the Santa Anita handicap. Because Seabiscuit's fans had made him the prohibitive favorite in the race, his rivals had become relative long shots. If the race-fixing conspirators could stop Seabiscuit, they could take advantage of the other horse's long odds, cash in huge bets, and disappear. The district attorney took the tip seriously. Manning was quickly hunted down and arrested before he could reach Seabiscuit's stall. In interrogation, he confessed. Because the police had caught him before he could carry out his crime, prosecutors didn't have much to charge him with. They settled for a charge of vagrancy and gave him the option of being expelled from the state or serving jail time. Manning chose the former. Police escorted him to the border and booted him across. The news broke on February 1st with front-page banner headlines. A ripple of horror spread across the backstretch. Sponging, an old race-fixing technique from racing's corrupt days, threatened horses' lives. The ensuing partial strangulation frequently triggered systemic, stress-related diseases that were often fatal. And unless a horseman was actively looking for the sponge, it could go undetected for weeks. Smith put Manning out of his mind and went back to tormenting the clockers. By mid-February, the reporters had figured out that when Howard went to the training track, Seabiscuit was soon to follow, and they had taken to trailing the owner around. Smith used this to his advantage. During the races, he sent Howard over to his box at the main Santa Anita track as a decoy, while he led Seabiscuit over to the training track nearby. Just before Seabiscuit worked out, Howard excused himself from his box for a moment. Sprinting to the training track, he stayed for the 1.5 minutes necessary for Seabiscuit to blaze through a mile workout. A moment later, he was back in his box. He'd been gone so briefly that no one suspected he'd done anything more interesting than visit the men's room. The workout demonstrated that the horse was ready for the February 19th San Carlos handicap, and for once, the track secretary relented, assigning him 130 pounds. Pollard, finally released from his suspension, was itching to ride him. On the day before the race, everything seemed to be coming together. But again, luck ran out. All night long, rain pounded the track. The next morning, the course was a swamp, and Smith scratched his horse for the fourth straight time. Fahrenheitis, a better mutter, was left in the race, and Pollard opted to ride her instead. The decision was the pivot point of his life. As the San Carlos field leaned around the far turn, Pollard was bent over the back of Fahrenheitis, who was racing along the rail in fourth. Around him, close enough to touch, was a dense phalanx of horses moving at terrific speed. Indian Broom on the rail, Pompoon on the outside, Mandingham right on Fahrenheitis's tail. Just inches ahead of Fahrenheitis was He Did, the horse famous for having sideswiped Seabiscuit's old stablemate Granville at the start of the 1936 Kentucky Derby, knocking his jockey off. Midway around the far turn at Santa Anita, He did it again. Leading the dense pack of horses around the turn, He Did took an awkward, sagging step. For an instant, he lost his momentum. The formation of runners collapsed, and horses began to rack up behind him. With nowhere to go and no time to stop herself, Fahrenheitis charged straight into the bottleneck. Pollard must have seen He Did's dark hindquarters suddenly in his face, too close. He had no time to react. Fahrenheitis reached forward, just as He Did, kicked out with his heels. Jockeys say there is a small, bright sound when hooves clip against each other, a cheery portent of the wreck that is likely to follow. Pollard must have heard it. Fahrenheitis's forelegs were kicked out from under her. Unable to catch herself, she pitched into a somersault at 40 miles per hour. Under Pollard, her head and neck dropped away as the ground heaved up. Pollard went down with her, his helpless form following the line of her fall, over her back and neck, and vanishing under her crashing body. She came down onto him with terrific force and skidded to a stop. Behind her, jockey Maurice Peters, aboard Mandingham, saw her plow into the track and knew he could not avoid her. Mandingham saw her too, and gathered himself up to make a desperate leap over her as she lay on the track. Perhaps, for an instant, it seemed as if he would make it. But just as he reared up and launched himself into the air, Phaeronidas thrust her forelegs out in front of her and lifted herself up directly into Mandingham's path. Mandingham slammed into her. The force of the collision knocked Phaeronidas down the track and flipped her upside down. Pollard, lying just beyond her, couldn't get out of her way. Her full weight came down on his chest. Mandingham flew over Phaeronidas, his legs tangling with hers. He bent in the air like a thrashing fish and spun into the ground shoulder first. Peters rode him down. From the grandstand came a heavy sound, then all fell silent. Peters, his ankle sprained, lifted himself up. Mandingham rose, his shoulder bruised and his foreleg gashed by Phaeronidas's hoof, but otherwise uninjured. Phaeronidas lay where she was. Peters limped over to Pollard and looked down. The left side of Pollard's chest was crushed. Charles Howard saw Pollard go down, staring in horror as Phaeronidas's flailing legs rolled skyward over him. He stared at the crumpled form, the great overturned animal. In an instant, he and Marcella were running blindly, pushing through the crowd. They sprinted through the mud to Pollard's side. The jockey was barely conscious, his mouth wide open. He was carried to the track infirmary. An ambulance arrived. The Howards climbed in and rode with Pollard to St. Luke's Hospital in Pasadena. Behind them, Smith sank down into the dirt beside Phaeronidas, who did not rise. Her back had been horribly wrenched. Her hind end was paralyzed. Smith somehow got her pulled into a van and taken back to the barn, where she lay helpless. Smith ordered x-rays. If her back was broken, it was over. He stayed at the barn and worked over her to save her life. At the hospital, the news was grim. Pollard's chest had virtually caved in. He had several broken ribs, a collarbone shattered into countless fragments, severe internal injuries, a broken shoulder, and a concussion. For several hours, he barely clung to life. Newspapers all over the country shouted the news. Some reported that Pollard had been killed. Up in Edmonton, his father stumbled into his house before his children, clutching a newspaper. Pollard's sister Edie saw the headline, "Seabiscuit's Jockey Near Death." 3 days passed. Pollard hovered. Smith and Howard sat by his bed. Finally, the jockey stabilized. The reporter slipped into his hospital room. Flashbulbs popped in his pale, unshaven face. His arm hung up in traction. Pollard didn't look at the reporters. He stared without expression at the half-page newspaper photos of himself, taken an instant before the wreck, showing him coiled over Phaeronidas's withers. Doctors told him he wouldn't ride again for at least a year. In the jockey's risky universe, everyone understood that some rider was going to profit from Pollard's loss. The redhead was not even out of danger before Howard and Smith were tailed by jockeys and agents seeking them out. Howard couldn't think about them. All he could think of was Pollard's injuries incurred on his horse. He couldn't bring himself to run Seabiscuit in the Santa Anita Handicap. Howard and Smith went to the hospital, and Pollard made himself clear. The horse had to run without him. After some consideration, Howard agreed. They had to find a new jockey. Again, Pollard asked Howard to hire George Wolfe. Smith thought it was a good idea. Wolfe had already committed to ride a horse named Today in the 100-grander and its final prep race, the San Antonio Handicap, but there was a chance they could get him out of the contract. Howard favored Eastern rider Sonny Workman, but Lynn and Bing had already signed him on to ride Ligurati. Smith, who operated under the assumption that all Easterners were up to no good, didn't trust Workman anyway. With the decision up in the air, and the San Antonio less than a week away, Howard, Smith, and Pollard parted. Howard made his announcement. "Seabiscuit will run if I have to ride him myself," he said. "Of course, that might put a little too much weight on Seabiscuit." With that, the flood began. Howard and Smith were besieged with telegrams and calls from jockeys all over the country. As Howard walked through the track, riders swirled around him like snow flurries. He and Smith conducted interviews in the tack room. Smith decided that if he couldn't have Wolf, he wanted a rough-and-tumble, freckle-faced Western rider named Noel Speck Richardson, a close friend of Pollard and Wolf. Howard couldn't make up his mind. Meanwhile, Smith honed Seabiscuit. The fact that the trainer was working the horse on Mondays was now the worst-kept secret in racing. When he led the horse onto the track on the Monday after Pollard's accident, 2,000 cheering fans greeted him. Smith asked Farrell Jones, who would be up for the workout, to wear his bulkiest leather jacket and use an extra-heavy saddle. All told, Jones, the saddle, and the jacket tipped the scales at 127 pounds. Smith then drilled Seabiscuit in tag-team fashion, sending him off alongside sprinter Limpio. He stationed the other two stablemates, Advocator and Chanceview, at pre-assigned places around the track. Limpio took off with Seabiscuit, and the two dueled through sprinter fractions. After half a mile, Advocator hooked up with Seabiscuit as Limpio dropped away, exhausted. In another half mile, Chanceview relieved Advocator, gunning alongside Seabiscuit for a final eighth of a mile. The final time was superb. It was a solid, taxing workout, whittling 10 pounds off of Seabiscuit's frame. Howard was buoyant. He began making side bets with friends that Seabiscuit would smash the track record in the San Antonio. Smith agreed that the horse was better than ever. "I have the big horse as good as hands can make him," he said. "Now it's up to the rider to get him home in front." Who that rider would be was still undecided. On the day before the San Antonio, Smith and Howard put Sonny Workman up on their colt, Aerial Cross, for a race. He rode beautifully, and Aerial Cross won. There had been a rider switch on Ligurati. Perhaps Howard had talked his son into going with another jockey, and Workman was suddenly available for the San Antonio and Santa Anita handicaps. Smith still didn't want him going anywhere near Seabiscuit, but it wasn't up to him. The next morning, Howard hired Workman, but only for the San Antonio. If he rode well in the race, it was implied Workman had the mount on Seabiscuit in the 100-grander. Smith took Workman to Pollard's hospital bed for a tutorial on the subtleties of riding Seabiscuit. It was there that the confusion began. Pollard told Workman all about Seabiscuit's oddities. The redhead stressed one point: do not use the whip. It is not clear why he gave this advice, since he usually gave the horse two taps during races. He was probably concerned that Workman, being unfamiliar with Seabiscuit, would overdo it and antagonize the horse. Knowing that the horse, when forced, tended to become obstreperous, Pollard may have decided to err on the side of caution and advise Workman to withhold the whip. The next afternoon, Smith and Howard stood on the grass in the infield and gave Workman their own instructions. They told him to use his judgment on strategy, but to give Seabiscuit two swats with his whip, once at the top of the stretch and once 70 yards from the wire. Smith was apparently unaware that his advice conflicted with Pollard's. Workman opted to follow the rider's instructions. The San Antonio was a terrible place to make a season debut after a long layoff. The track, though fast, was thick. The field was formidable, featuring Seabiscuit's old rivals Aneroid and Indian Broom, plus Today with Wolf up. Seabiscuit was carrying 130 pounds, 12 more than second high weight Aneroid, and as much as 20 more than other horses in the field. The man on his back was a stranger, unfamiliar with his quirks, with only a few hours of preparation and conflicting advice on how to ride him. It was a formula for disaster. As Seabiscuit cantered to the post for the San Antonio, Pollard lay on his hospital cot at St. Luke's. He was in severe pain. Nurses had stacked sandbags all along his left side to prevent him from turning over on his broken chest. His left arm was in traction, a pulley slung to his wrist. His right, pinching a cigarette, was stretched out for the knob on a radio, which the nurses had perched on a stack of magazines. He fiddled with a tuning knob, trying to find the station that would air the race. Turf rider Sid Ziff, from the Los Angeles Evening Herald, slipped into the room. Pollard greeted him with a pained smile. "Good old Biscuit," he said. "You'll break the world record today." He surveyed his arm and winced. "It doesn't matter that I'm here. Sonny Workman's up out there. Sonny's a great jockey." He lay back and fell silent, listening to radio caller Clem McCarthy tell his audience about the crash of Fahrenheitis. He stubbed out his cigarette. He was agitated and unhappy. He was out of place, here on the cot while his horse ran without him. Miles away, Seabiscuit was coming unwound. Workman couldn't get him settled down. The horse reverted to his rebellious habits in the starting gate, bulling forward and raising a fuss. He reared, flung the starter aside, and broke through the front of the gate. They loaded him again, but Workman couldn't quiet him. The frustrated assistant starter began waving a rope back and forth in front of the horse's face to distract him. Just before the bell rang, Seabiscuit lunged. The assistant starter caught him and shoved him backward at the same instant that the field sprang away. Seabiscuit came out late, only to be bumped by a straggling horse to his outside. By the time he recovered, he was in seventh, four lengths behind Aneroid and Indian Broom. Pollard jerked partially upright, his hair mussed from the pillow. "Biscuit!" he shouted. "Get going, Biscuit!" He wiggled closer to the radio. Word came that Seabiscuit was inching forward, and he relaxed a little. Workman held Seabiscuit back, around the first turn and down the long backstretch. On the far turn, he began sweeping around the field. As Seabiscuit pulled into the stretch, only Indian Broom and Aneroid remained to be caught. "Here comes Seabiscuit!" shouted McCarthy, and the crowd noise echoed into Pollard's hospital room. "Go get those bombs, Seabiscuit!" Pollard sang out. "Get 'em, you old devil!" In the stands, Smith was focusing on Workman's hands. The jockey was not cocking his whip. He thought he didn't need to. Seabiscuit was picking off horses and running freely beneath him. In mid-stretch, he collared Indian Broom, then took aim at Aneroid, who was alone on the lead but weakening. They clipped past the 70-yard pole. Seabiscuit was lopping a foot off of Aneroid's lead with every stride, but room was running out. Workman thought he would get there. Smith felt the anger rising in him. He could see that the horse was fooling around, playing with Aneroid. Workman didn't seem to notice. He just sat there. The whip lay flat on Seabiscuit's neck. "Aneroid is leading, still leading," chanted McCarthy. Pollard rose up as if in the saddle, yanking at the pulley holding his arm. The sheet slid from his body, and the sandbags tumbled free as he bent before the radio. "Go get him, Biscuit," he pleaded. "You broke his heart once, break it again." He crouched over the bed, as if moving over his horse. His forehead was puckered in sweat. Smith was livid. The whip was sitting there in Workman's hand. Seabiscuit's ears were flicking around. The horse seemed to be waiting for the signal to go for the kill. It never came. Aneroid was driving with everything he had, and Seabiscuit was just jogging with him, a cat batting a stunned mouse. He was having a fine time. His head was still behind. He edged up a little as the wire came, but it was too late. Aneroid won by a short neck. Pollard wilted into his pillows, drenched in sweat. "It isn't right," he said. A nurse rushed in and began hoisting the sandbags back on the bed. "Who finished second?" she asked. "Biscuit did." "I told you should have been on him," she replied. "Maybe," said Pollard. "Only Workman gave him a good ride. It wasn't his fault." A moment later, Pollard was tense again. "By God, maybe there is some way I can get this shoulder fixed up for next Saturday. Do you think so? If only I could, I can try," he smiled. "That's talking like a child, isn't it?" he said. The nurse left. Pollard's shoulder began to throb. He realized that he had wrenched it during the race. He reached for a black cord, pinned to his sheet, and buzzed the nurse's station. When the nurse returned, he pleaded with her to sneak him a beer.
"Just one, nursey," he said. "I sure desire one. I just went through hell."
Pollard had always been, like virtually everyone else at the track, a social drinker, imbibing just enough to be happy and noisy on weekend outings with other jockeys, but not enough to become dependent. But analgesia was in its infancy in the 1930s. Pollard's injuries, involving fragmented bones that ground together each time he moved, were agonizing, and medicine offered few practical solutions. He must have been suffering just as much emotionally. For the first time since he was 15, Pollard was deprived of the intoxicating rush of riding. Alcohol brought relief. Pollard began drinking more regularly and heavily. He was on the road to alcoholism. At Santa Anita, the press came down hard on Workman. He admitted his mistake. Pollard supported him publicly. Howard announced that he was satisfied with Workman and that the jockey would retain the mount for the Santa Anita handicap. He spoke too soon. Smith was hopping mad. He couldn't believe that Workman hadn't noticed Seabiscuit pricking his ears, an unmistakable sign that a horse is not concentrating. And he was furious that the jockey had disobeyed his instructions. Sitting in his tack room 2 days after the race, he vented his frustrations. Workman must have ridden according to other orders. "He didn't obey mine," he sniped. "Seabiscuit will win the Santa Anita handicap. He is the best horse, he is fit, and he is ready. All I want is a jockey who will obey my orders." Howard, uncomfortable with Smith's excoriation of Workman, made a point of praising the jockey to reporters. He wanted to stay with Workman, arguing that the rider wouldn't make the same mistake twice. Smith dug in. Workman had to go. Workman went, bitterly complaining that he had ridden the horse exactly as Pollard had told him to. On February 28th, Smith tacked up Seabiscuit and guided him to the track before a Monday crowd. Howard and Alfred Vanderbilt joined them. Vanderbilt was presenting Seabiscuit with the Horse and Horseman plaque for Horse of the Year. They had no jockey to complete the picture, so Smith boosted Farrell Jones up on Seabiscuit. After a parade before the crowd and a brief, somewhat subdued ceremony in which Vanderbilt called Seabiscuit the greatest horse of the year in America, they took Seabiscuit back to his stall. Everybody knew that the Horse and Horseman Award wasn't the one that counted. One good thing had happened to Seabiscuit in the San Antonio. Today, with George Wolfe aboard, had run a miserable race. Knowing that Pollard was going to bat for him with Seabiscuit's connections, Wolfe had been trying everything he could think of to get out of his contract to ride today in the 100-grander, including offering $1,000 to the horse's owner. The skill of a man like Wolfe was worth a lot more than $1,000 in a $100,000 race, and the owner turned down the offer. But in the San Antonio, today ran so abysmally that his trainer concluded he had no chance in the Santa Anita handicap. He released Wolfe from his obligations. Smith and Pollard were positive that Wolfe was the right man for Seabiscuit. Howard wanted proof. Wolfe gave him just that. In a meeting a few hours after the Horse and Horseman Award presentation, the Iceman offered Smith and Howard a glimpse into the mind of a riding genius. He laid out all of Seabiscuit's predilections and weaknesses in great detail. Howard was dumbfounded. Wolfe knew more about his horse than he did. Howard asked him how he could possibly have known so much. Wolfe replied that his seat to the rear of Seabiscuit in several of his winning races had given him a good spot from which to study the horse, and he had simply taken the opportunity. He also recalled in surprising detail his one unpleasant ride on Seabiscuit 3 years earlier, when the horse was still with Fitzsimmons. He described how he would ride the horse if given the chance. Howard and Smith were speechless. Wolfe had just told them exactly what they were about to tell him. Wolfe had the job. Wolfe left his new employers with a prediction. If the track was fast in the Santa Anita handicap, he'd win it. Wolf stopped off at a betting venue and bought a ticket on Seabiscuit to win. Then he drove over to St. Luke's Hospital and gave the ticket to Pollard. The two old friends sat together, talking of Seabiscuit,